Well, good morning. How are you all doing? Good? Good. Well, it's a privilege for me to be here. As he mentioned, I feel like I'm one of you, as kind of full disclosure here. But we did raise our three daughters. We homeschooled them. We're all set here. And I don't need this, right? Great. Thank you. All three of our daughters are adopted. They're from overseas. And so homeschooling was a great way for us to get them into this culture, help them understand things. We have nothing but fond memories of homeschooling them. It was a great experience. And things have kind of come full circle. Now I'm at Arizona Christian University, where we have a large contingent of homeschool students. And we do a lot of worldview research with all our students. I'm not supposed to say this to anybody but the president of the university, so don't tell him that I told you this. But our homeschool students are our best students. And that's not my feeling. That's based on the research, so we know it's true. So it's, anyway, so, you know, because of our homeschooling experience, I'm well acquainted with a lot of the, not only the thinking behind homeschooling, but the challenges that we face. And if I hear somebody coming up to me one more time using the word socialization, even though I'm a sociologist, you know, I'm probably going to slap them in the face. So that's where we're at with that. So I don't have too much time today. I want to cover an awful lot of ground with you in a short period of time, so I'm going to jump right in. Let me give you the big picture of what's going on in our culture today. You know this. I know that you know this because I just saw your scores on that survey that you did. And so you get things pretty well, and I'll share those with you in a little bit. But of course, we live in the midst of war. And I'm not talking about the Ukraine or Israel or those places. They've got some serious things going on. But every single day, you and I and our children, our neighbors, everybody around us lives in the midst of war. And it is a multifaceted war. We tend to see this war, it's a spiritual war in nature, of course, but we see the heightened intensity of that war recently through various manifestations, whether those would be physical, material, psychological, or emotional. And as we read the scriptures, particularly Paul's writings about spiritual warfare, we gain a lot of insight into who we're up against, the nature of our enemy, the kinds of weapons that are at our disposal, and the absolute necessity of us embracing those weapons so that we can fight the war well. But we see a lot of that in terms of the kinds of challenges that we face in many different dimensions of our culture today. No matter what dimension you turn to, whether it's the economic dimension or the family dimension, the moral dimension, political dimension, on down the line, you will see challenge after challenge after challenge, and it seems like they're coming at us faster and deeper and more profoundly than ever before. I'm not sure that that's true. If you're a student of history, there have been some real daunting times in America's history. But this is not a period to laugh at in terms of the nature of the challenges that we face. And so as we look at that, I would suggest to you that really we are facing an existential challenge in America today. Will this nation continue to exist? And it depends, frankly, on one thing. And that's whether or not Christians are going to fight the good fight for the cause of the kingdom of Christ. If we do not do that, then yes, we will lose America. And that's the kind of thing that I want to talk to you about here today, is how we can do that. Now, to understand the nature of all these crises or challenges that we face, let me point out that the reason that we face challenges in all those different dimensions is because of the decisions that people are making. We can't simply turn east and look at Washington, D.C. and say it's all their problem, because it's not. It's the problem of the American people. Every day, every one of us is making hundreds of choices. When you look at any culture, culture is nothing more, nothing less than the accumulation of the choices that the people in that culture are making. And so if you don't like where America's at, you don't like the trajectory that we're on for the future, you have to understand then it's not the problem of our president. Although, but I won't go there. The real problem is the choices that the American people are making or allowing others to make for them. And so we have to be aware of all of that. See, because all of those choices are a product of the worldview of the American people. And that really is, I think, one of the greatest challenges that you face in homeschooling, is how do you develop the worldview of your child? If we were to look at all the decisions that you and your spouse and your children, your pastor, your neighbors, everybody is making, the accumulation of those is what determines our culture, and what determines that is the worldview of the people making those decisions. And so given all of that, I would say the logical conclusion is if you don't like where we're at, therefore what we have to do is change the prevailing worldview of the American population. Because they'll continue making the same choices, the same decisions, until we change the basis on which they make their choices and their decisions, and that is their worldview. God spoke to this in his word when in Galatians 6 he said, you reap what you sow. And that's exactly what's happening in America today. It's not like it's coming out of left field and we can say, how did we get here? How did this happen to us? Well, frankly, we did it to ourselves. And we did it to ourselves because now for multiple decades, consecutive decades, we have allowed Americans to depart from a biblical worldview and instead select from a number of others. I'm going to show you some of the current information related to that in just a few minutes. If we look at the nature of this war that we're immersed in, here's kind of a statistical look at it. You know, when I was introduced, the comment was made that I love the Yankees. Get over it, okay? You know, I'm from Manhattan, and we have an expression there, you don't have to like it, you just have to deal with it. So that's what I'm giving you here. I got started actually doing research. So my love for numbers came from having baseball cards. So parents, don't stop your kids from having baseball cards, okay? They can be a good thing. All my friends love the pictures on the front of the baseball cards with the pitchers in the middle of their windup and the batters, you know, up at the plate waiting for the pitch. I love the backside that had that microscopic print, all numbers. You know, my friend's eyes would glaze over. I looked and I said, wait a minute, this tells a story. This tells me everything I need to know about this individual as a baseball player. I can tell you a lot about it just from looking at the patterns within these numbers. And so as a 6, 7, 8-year-old, can we all say nerd? Sure, yeah. But that's what got me started on this. So I want to show you some numbers that show us a little bit about what's going on in the spiritual war in America today. If you were to look at our nation 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when 45 years ago I started doing all this, and at that point we had close to 9 out of 10 Americans who called themselves Christian. That number has dropped to 66% today, and it continues to drop. But then you say, all right, but that's such a broad designation. Let's go a little bit deeper. All right, let's look at people who attend Christian churches on a regular basis. We'll call that once a month or more. It drops from the 66% down to 36%, just a little bit more than half. In fact, for the first time since I've been measuring this, and probably for the first time in more than a century, we now have more people who never attend a church than attend a church at least once a month. We can go a little bit deeper because attending church doesn't, according to my research at least, actually have much of an impact on a person's life. But let's look at those people who we might call born-again Christians. Now, this isn't a term that we ask people, do you call yourself that? We look at whether or not they say, you know, when I die, I know that I'm going to heaven only because I've confessed my sins and accepted Jesus Christ as my Savior. If we consider that group of people to be born-again Christians, and only God truly knows, I'm not trying to take his place, but I'm just trying to estimate where do we stand as a church, as a culture, what we find is that that number has dropped down to just 1 out of 3 adults, 34%. In fact, we've got a group of people now that I've been measuring for a number of years we call the don'ts. People who don't know if God exists, don't believe that God exists, or don't care if God exists. That number has gone from the single digits when I started doing this research 4 decades ago, up now to the equivalent of the number of born-again Christians in our country, also 1 out of 3 adults. And of all the different faith groups in America today, that's the fastest growing. We could look at then something that I think is much more significant toward understanding what's happening in America, and that's worldview. We'll dive much deeper into this in a few moments, but how many people have a biblical worldview? That is, the foundation for all the choices they make are God's word, the scriptures. That drops down to 4%. And then what determines how we're going to fight this war is that last number that I've got up there. How many people appear to be disciples of Jesus? Again, God is God, only he knows. But if I take the 6 criteria that Jesus gave us in the scriptures of what constitutes a disciple and measure that across the country, that's how I come to 3% of American adults are probably disciples of Jesus. Now, when I've shared that number with a lot of Christians across the country over the last 6 months, one of the reactions that I've gotten is, come on, George, let's be real. I mean, we can't really fight a war with 3% of the population on our side. Let's just admit it, we've lost, and pray for Jesus to hurry back. And my response is, you dimwit, don't you understand what's going on here? Let's take a look at how America operates. This is a demonstrably false perspective that we cannot win this war. Do you realize that all of the chaos and turbulence that's happening sexually in America started from a group of less than 1% of the population 30 years ago putting together a plan and saying, we're going to change the way America thinks and feels about sexuality? And they stuck with the plan. They were committed. They were passionate. And today, more than 2 out of 3 Americans believe that gay marriage is legitimate marriage, that homosexual relationships are legitimate love relationships, and on and on down that road. There are a lot of kids here, so I don't want to dive too deep into that. But understand that that group of people started with fewer than 1%, and they made a radical shift in our culture because they were committed to it. We also know that that argument that we can't win with just 3% is absolutely irrelevant. Why? Because if we're part of that 3% and God is on our side, we can do anything we choose that's in his will. And so we don't have to worry about that. God never waits till he has a majority to transform a culture. In fact, if you look through the pages of Scripture, the Old Testament is great about this, where you see God coming into play and changing cultures. And how does he do that? He'll go to a place that's wicked, a place that's increasingly embracing sin, and to turn it around, he'll call out the remnant, the people who are fully sold out to him. And typically what he'll do is he'll say, you know what, this is too many of you. I'm not even going to use all you because then you're going to take credit for it. And so what he does instead is he'll take a small slice of the remnant and he'll put them into play. He'll send them to the front lines of that battle. And God always wins. That's the situation that we find ourselves in today. God is looking for that radical remnant of his followers in America today who are going to say, here I am, Lord, send me. I'm ready. I'll do whatever you want. Unto death, I am willing to fight your fight because it is the good fight. So why should you homeschool? Why should you continue to homeschool? Because you are raising that remnant. If America is going to be saved, it's going to be saved because of the children that you're raising today. The future of the church in America depends on people like you, families like yours, children like yours, rising up and being the people that God can count on. And so keep in mind that as you're educating your child, your top priority ought not to be to get them into Harvard, God forbid, or even Arizona Christian University or Patrick Henry or, you know, any of the handful of really good Christian universities across the country. Your priority is to prepare them for spiritual war, because that's where they're going to spend the rest of their lives. So is education, math, science, language, all of that, is that important? Yes, it's important. But it's not as important as doing everything you can to make sure that what you're doing is raising a disciple of Jesus. Now, I keep talking about this concept of disciples. That is your primary job. When God asks you how you did at raising and educating your child, he's not going to ask what SAT scores did they get. What he's going to ask is, do they radically love me? Did they devote themselves to serving me? Did you do everything in your power? You can't force them to do those things. But did you do everything that you knew how? Did you use all the resources you could muster to facilitate them becoming disciples? What does that mean? Well, there are six times, and I wrote this book called Raising Spiritual Champions. If some of the things I say you don't catch here, a lot of what I'm talking about is in that book. And I know they've got the book here. But in there, I talk about six times Jesus said, you will be my disciple if, the first three things there that you find in the book of John, or you cannot be my disciple unless, three things he listed in Luke 14. And so that's how I get, by the way, to the 3% of adults in America being disciples of Jesus, by measuring those things. But what we're talking about, someone who's a disciple, their life is completely transformed. They no longer care what the world wants or expects of them. All they care about is that they're deeply, profoundly connected to God, intimate with him and doing his will. And recognize that a key part of that is what you are teaching them spiritually, the beliefs and the translation of those beliefs into a lifestyle. Why? Because you do what you believe. You do what you believe. And so I'm going to talk about what that has to do with discipleship. But see, the sad thing I found in doing all the research for that book, Raising Spiritual Champions, is that in America, when I talk with Christians about, you know, what does it mean to be a disciple? What does it mean if your child, for your child to be a disciple? And the most common answers I got is, well, he or she's a good person, or they go to church all the time, or they believe in God or Jesus. Don't be fooled by that. That's good. That's necessary. But even Satan believes in the existence of God and Jesus. So, I mean, that's not the key. You know, what does it mean to be a disciple? Well, they read the Bible. Yeah, okay. So do a lot of people who take college courses who don't believe in it, or even teach those courses. You know, they pray to God. They're raised in a Christian home. They were homeschooled. That in and of itself doesn't do it. What is the substance of what's going on? See, we've got a grand calling from God that has different components within it. And that calling is made up of the Great Commission, the fact that we know we're here to make disciples, not just converts. You remember before I showed you 34% of Americans are born-again Christians, yet only 3% are disciples. That's the difference between a convert and a disciple. You know, somebody who is really, truly transformed. They didn't just take out the eternal fire insurance, but they signed up for the front lines of the battle. And, you know, that part of our calling has to do with the great commandment, our ultimate purpose in life, to know, love, and serve God with all our heart, mind, strength, and soul. Part of it is our commitment Is this the top priority in our lives? And part of it is the consignment, the great consignment. We are passing this faith on to our children, to their generation, and then we're going to support them as grandparents and great-grandparents as they pass it on to their children. This is part of what we do. That's our legacy. And so, you know, when we're thinking about what a disciple is, it's somebody who imitates the master. And of course, our master is Jesus. The beauty of it is that God wants us to be disciples, and so he gave us the plan. He gave us the guidebook, the Bible. But understand that you cannot force your children or anybody else to be a disciple. That's their choice. We have to help them come to the place where they can make an informed choice, and it is appealing enough to them and comprehensible enough to them that they say, yeah, I want a piece of that. That's what I want to devote my life to. It's not just about information, it's about transformation. And so they have to see what this looks like and understand the price that they're going to pay, but know the outcome as well. We know that if you want your child to be a disciple, it's all about their worldview. And so I pray that whatever you're doing to raise your children, you're bringing everything back to worldview. One of the reasons why I'm winding up my career at Arizona Christian University, that's my final resting stop on the journey that God's had me on for 50 years, is that it's a school that says we are going to take biblical truth and integrate it into every single subject matter, every major, every class, every sports team, every extracurricular activity. We don't really have coaches for our sports teams. We have disciple makers who happen to love the sport. And so they spend their time discipling the young men and women who are participating in those sports, recognizing that sports is just another entree to becoming a deeper disciple. That's the kind of thing that it's important for you to be doing with your children. And so why do we want them to know what's in the Bible? Because that's how you begin to develop a biblical worldview. Why is a biblical worldview important? Because they need to think like Jesus. That's what having a biblical worldview is. You understand the scriptures well enough that when you're confronted with a decision to make, you can make the same decision that Jesus would have made. So you think like Jesus. Here's a problem, and hopefully I'll have enough time to show you this toward the end of the session. A lot of times, that's where we as Christians reside. It's in our heads, and it doesn't get translated into a lifestyle. See, but to be a true disciple of Jesus, thinking like Jesus isn't the end game. You need to think like Jesus because you want them to live like Jesus. And remember what I said, you do what you believe. So you've got to help them not only believe the right stuff, but then figure out how do we translate that into a lifestyle. Now, your primary role in homeschooling is not that of teacher. It's that of disciple maker. Now, you may say, yeah, it's semantics. It's not semantics. It's a major mind shift of thinking, you know what, I want them to be well-educated so they can do well in the world. But no matter how smart they are, no matter how good their grades are, no matter how much they learn in different classes, if they are not a disciple, they're not going to make it in life. Sure, maybe they'll make a lot of money, they'll have a lot of toys, but they will not make it in God's eyes. And that's the critical dimension. So understand that you reproduce who you are. You can't give what you don't have. And so as you're thinking about who your children are going to become, maybe the homeschooling process is just as much about you learning about Jesus, about the scriptures, about a biblical lifestyle, as it is about your children learning those things. Because you can't give what you don't have. You can only give what you do have. And so hopefully you've got enough Jesus, enough scripture, enough of that spiritual warfare mentality in you that as you're raising your child to be who God put them on the planet to be and whom he entrusted them to you to raise up to be, that you've got the goods to give to them. Nobody becomes a disciple by accident. It's got to be very intentional, very strategic, very consistent. And so think about what you're doing there. You don't make the person, whether it's your child or anybody else, into a disciple. That's the Holy Spirit doing that. But the Holy Spirit can use you in that process if you're available and you have the goods. And so recognize that that is your identity. You are a disciple maker. You know, of course, that the only people who can make disciples are disciples. That, again, is one of the problems that we have with that 3%. Why does that number keep dropping? Because for several decades now, I've been watching this, and what we see is that disciples are not making disciples. Disciples are hoarding the goodness of God for themselves, rather than saying, you know what, this is a gift from God that I'm to freely share with others. My job, the whole Genesis 12 principle is I'm blessed to be a blessing. And so we've got to turn around and do what we can to disciple others. But being a disciple maker, get ready for it, because it's a declaration of war against the kingdom of darkness. And so if you think you're being persecuted before you make that declaration, hang on to your hats. How do you make disciples? The book that I'm writing right now, all the research that I'm doing right now, is related to how do we do that with adults. Raising spiritual champions is how do we do that with children. And I'll explain why that's so vitally important. But disciple making is all about relationships. It's not about information. It's about relationships. That relationship has to be based on trust. But in that relationship, you invest a lot of time, a lot of shared experiences. It's got to be a Bible-centric relationship where you're constantly going back and talking about the things of God. But discipleship is based on dialogue as well. And not just where you're telling somebody what they ought to think or do or read, but you're asking questions. That's what Socratic dialogue is. You don't tell people the answers. You ask them questions that allow them to tell you what they're thinking. You ask why they're thinking that. You ask how they came to that conclusion. You ask how that's working for them. And then based on that information that they've given to you, you get to start giving them other options to reflect upon. That's how people grow. People don't grow by us telling them, this is the right answer, believe it or else. That pedantic approach is ineffective. That conversational approach can be very effective. But then you've got to model it for them. Once you've put that possibility on the table for them to consider, what happens is they watch you to see what it looks like. I'm going to jump ahead to something I was going to say later, which is one of the things that I found in our research with parents is that America's children, a large majority of America's children today don't trust their parents anymore. Why is that? In interviewing the kids around the country, did a big national sample with kids, trying to understand these things. And they told us they didn't understand, or they didn't trust their parents. We told them, well, why is that? They said, and these were not their words, I'm kind of putting it in our language. They said, look, I'm a kid. I'm trying to figure out how life works. I'm trying to figure out who I am, how I fit into the world, where I'm going with my life, who I want to be, how I'm going to get there. And of course, these are all the big questions that a worldview answers. So what they're basically telling us is, I'm trying to figure out my worldview. And we said, well, what does that have to do with you not trusting your parents? They said, oh, simple. Because I listen to my parents and they tell me what I should think or do or believe, and then I watch them and they do something completely different. And I said, so what difference does that make? And they said, well, what it tells me is they're just as confused as I am. And so why should I follow them? What I'm trying to do is to follow somebody or some group or something that has figured out how life works. And that's who I'm going to take my cues from. So consistency is absolutely critical. What you teach, you must model for them behaviorally. They've got to see what it looks like. I may not get to this later because I'm just talking and talking and talking up here. But one of the things that we've discovered is that the biggest influence on children today is arts and entertainment media, bar none. It's not even close. It's like a factor of 5 to 1 in terms of influence, more than any other element of influence. Why is that? Because think about what the media do. A child or anybody, but children in particular. Let's say they watch a television program, 24 minutes without commercials of content. Let's say they watch a movie, 90 minutes of content. They listen to a pop song, 3.5, 4 minutes of content. They play a video game for 15 or 20 minutes. Every one of those bits of media is communicating worldview messages constantly. But because of how media is developed, the creators of that can take their time and put it together into a consistent set of messages. That's why children, whether it's preteens, teenagers, college students, they love to spend time with media because it's consistent. It's not fighting within itself, oh, gee, what do I say? What do I believe? What does it look like? And so the media is having enormous influence. It's much easier to put together a 90-minute movie that consistently conveys worldview messages than it is to be a parent for 24 hours. Because for 24 hours, your kid will be watching you like a hawk, looking for those inconsistencies which, you know, on their meter, you know, the dial goes over to red. Danger, they don't know what they're talking about. Or what they're talking about has no relationship to how they live. It can't be true. You know, that happens. So we've got to be consistent in what we're doing. Mutual accountability in this discipling relationship, critically important. If I blow it, I want you to tell me because I want to be more Christ-like. The only way I'm going to get there is if people who know me and love me and hang out with me are helping to shape me all the time. So, you know, those are the kinds of things we're looking for. The dangers that we've got in terms of this process, and I'd ask you to think of if any of this goes on in your home. You know, the dominant style of parenting in America today is what in the book I called outsourcing, which is where parents love their kids so much and the parents are so busy or so ill-skilled at different things, they go outside the house to hire experts to raise their children for them. So they hire tutors, they hire coaches, they drop kids off at church. They find all of the best professionals they can find, saying, look, I just did the best I could for my children. But the problem is when you do that, you're no longer raising your child. You no longer have any say in the worldview that they are being exposed to by the people who are raising them. And so our children are consistently exposed to errant worldviews because we put them in those situations. You know, I talked about the lack of trust. Most parents have no plan for where they're taking their child in their life other than I want them to be smart, educated, healthy, happy, etc. You know, so there are all kinds of problems in terms of what we are and are not doing in discipling our children. And so all of that has led to the worldview crisis in America today. Now, let me quickly show you some elements about what's going on in terms of worldview. Because after you leave this conference, I'd love for you to go back and think about how am I intentionally teaching worldview to my child or children? What does it look like and what am I doing about that so that they not only read it on the paper if they're getting to do that, but they see me carrying it out in my life. We know that, as I've said, your worldview is the sum of your beliefs and your behavior. In America, a person's worldview, well, really around the world, a worldview starts forming at 15 to 18 months of age and is fully formed by the age of 13. That is the window of opportunity that we have. And so if you want to shape someone's worldview, get there before the age of 13. Because after that, you've got double the work. They'll have a worldview at that point, and if it's not a biblical worldview and you want it to be, step number one at that point is you've got to get rid of that old worldview, exceedingly difficult. And then you've got to replace it with a biblical worldview. Much, much more efficient and more effective to do that when a child is young. A lot of people said to me, well, I'm not worried about it because when they get to high school or college or whatever, we'll take care of it then. No, I did a longitudinal study and found that most Americans, a huge majority of Americans, die with the same worldview intact that they had at the age of 13. They may have figured out how to articulate it better. They may have changed a few things along the way. But unless they respond to a life crisis that so shakes them up that they reconsider everything that they've believed up to that point, a person is likely to die with that same worldview. Why does that matter? Because I also know it's exceedingly uncommon to find somebody who does not have a biblical worldview who is also a disciple of Jesus, someone who lives like Christ. Now, if you think about it logically, that makes sense. If you do what you believe, if you don't think like Jesus, biblical worldview, you're not going to live like Jesus. If you're not living like Jesus and thinking like Jesus, why would you want to be his disciple? How could you be his disciple? Remember back one of the early slides I showed you, 4% have a biblical worldview, 3% are disciples. Makes all the sense in the world. We know that there are four different stages of worldview development. This always cracks me up. I put up pretty pictures and people take pictures with their phones. All the really good data, too many words. Yeah. It's kind of like Mozart. I don't know if you saw the movie Amadeus. In there, the emperor complains about Mozart's music, and Mozart says, "What's the problem?" And the emperor says, "Too many notes." And it's kind of like my presentation's too many words. But it's that a stage of ages 1 through 12 where children are deciding who they're going to be, how they're going to become that person, what it's going to look like throughout their life. They're testing, they're experimenting, they're going back and forth until ultimately by around the age of 12, 13, 14, they establish the worldview that's going to be the underpinning of their life. It's not until people get into their 60s or 70s that we tend to stop and go back. Americans are not reflective people. We don't stop and think. America would not be America today if we were reflective people. America's a nation of people who take action. We do things. We make stuff happen. We create. We innovate. But in the course of doing that, we tend not to sit there and think about, so how did that go? We're off to the next thing. Spiritually, that's very dangerous for us. We know that there have been a number of world leaders who recognized this and said, give me a child and I'll have them for the rest of their life, because they recognize that's what determines who they're going to be and how they're going to live. And yet, it's not working out well in America today. Why not? Because there are so many different worldviews that people get to choose from. One of the things that we study at the beginning of every calendar year at the Cultural Research Center at Arizona Christian University is people's worldview. We're the only research center in the world that every year tracks the incidence of worldview in its nation's population. And so every year we're looking at how many people buy into all these different worldviews. Why does this graphic make a difference? Because these are the worldviews that your children are being exposed to every day. These are the worldviews that they're trying to decide between. And one of those is the biblical worldview. It's formally known as biblical theism. But it's just one of the choices that they've got. Here's what's going on in America today in terms of worldview. You've got the 4% who have a biblical worldview. If you look at the well-defined worldviews, secular humanism, postmodernism, nihilism, Eastern mysticism, Marxism, all those and others, what you find is those haven't gained traction in our culture either. Very few people are sold out to those worldviews, just as very few people are sold out to biblical theism or the biblical worldview. What are Americans doing then? Well, look down at the bottom there, that long red stripe where it says syncretism. That's the reigning worldview in America. What is syncretism? Syncretism is where you say, I don't like any one of those worldviews. I don't think it's completely right. But I like a few things that biblical theism has, so I'm going to embrace those ideas. And I like some of the stuff that Marxism offers, so I'm going to embrace those few ideas. And I like some of what Eastern mysticism talks about and how they live, so I'm going to embrace a few of their things. Syncretism is bolting together a lot of disparate elements from a variety of worldviews into a customized, personalized worldview. And so that's where Americans are at. They're not embracing any one thing. They're taking a little bit of everything and they're cutting and pasting it and making up their own worldview. Why can they do this? Because as parents, we paid no attention to the development of their worldview. We just wanted to see outward signs that they were, quote unquote, good people. And so this is what we wind up with. We know that people in America tend to buy into a worldview based on how it makes them feel. This is another characteristic of Americans. We're not thinkers, we're feelers. Many of the people who really succeed in America are deep thinkers. Why? Because they're the aberration. They're not the norm. All the people around them get to feel whether or not they like what that person's thinking, whether or not they feel like it's going to be helpful to them, whether or not they feel like it's the right thing to embrace. So we've got this issue where we're kind of thinking with our emotions in America, and that's not serving us well. What we really need to do to embrace a biblical worldview is to buy into truth and recognize that God is the embodiment of truth, and he's passed that truth on to us in a form that we can understand the Bible. And he gave it specifically to us so that we would buy into truth. But look at this chart. I mentioned only 4% of American adults have a biblical worldview, but even groups that we tend to think, well, these people get it, they don't. People who regularly attend evangelical churches, only 1 out of every 8 of them have a biblical worldview. People who are, as I described, theologically defined born-again Christians, only 1 out of every 8 of them have a biblical worldview. The parents of children under the age of 2 in America, only 2% of them have a biblical worldview. Can't give what you don't have. 98 out of every 100 parents in America do not have a biblical worldview. Are they going to be raising disciples of Jesus? No, because not only are they not disciples, but they cannot raise anything but what they are. And so that's not going to happen. So this is why it's so critical that the 3% who are disciples in America recognize the nature of this war is that right now, I've got to dedicate myself to the war. Because if I don't, the American church is in deeper trouble than it is now. Oh, by the way, let me go back to one thing there. At the bottom of the list, look at that. I talked about outsourcing and the fact that so many Christian parents or quasi-Christian parents, self-identified Christian parents, or parents who just want to break from their kids, drop their kids off at church and say, okay, this is where they're going to get their spiritual training. Do you realize that only 12% of the children's pastors in Christian churches across America have a biblical worldview? 1 out of every 8 children's pastors. You say, wow, how could the senior pastor allow that to happen? Because only 37% of senior pastors have a biblical worldview. And there's a much larger discussion behind all this. But yeah, so you've got to be careful too, even when you take your child to a church. Don't assume that it's a place where they're going to get good biblical teaching. Biblical worldview in America has been declining for 30 years, a pretty consistent decline. We never hear about this because most people who attend churches think they have a biblical worldview. About 2 out of 3 of them do, only 1 out of 10 actually do. And so, you know, if we were to look at this generationally, what we would find is if we start breaking down what goes into a person's worldview, generation to generation to generation, we are losing ground. Why is that? Increasingly because parents are not paying attention to this. And so this, I would beg you, make this a top priority in what you're doing with children. It's great that they know U.S. history, the real U.S. history. It's great that they can speak English well and parse sentences properly and all that. But the most important thing is that they become disciples. And so as we look at all this, statistical realities, you know, very few disciples, very few with a biblical worldview. What do we do? So one way I'd like you to think about it is that homeschooling is very much an important choice that you made. It was a difficult choice. You're the aberration, you're not the norm. It's difficult to do. You know, I come from the Socialist Republic of California. You know, I've been living there for 40 years, going back and forth to Arizona, our house there, at the school there. But, I mean, in California, boy, do they hassle you if you try to homeschool your children. They're on top of you all the time. So you've got to be committed to this process and understand the secret sauce of homeschooling is that you have the capacity to train your child to have a biblical worldview. There's probably no other place in America where they will get that. So you are serving an absolutely vital function. What you're doing is you're laying the groundwork for building these children to be disciples. Now, I will say in doing the research for Raising Spiritual Champion, when we interviewed parents about what are your priorities, what we found, that the priorities were academic achievement, allowing the children to have fun, and making sure that physically they're healthy. I'd ask you to think about what are your priorities. Those things aren't bad, but they can't be the top priority on the list. So just, you know, do a little heart check there. Figure out where you're at. They tell me I've got 4 minutes left, so let me figure out what else I really need to tell you here. Okay, that little test that you took before, not a test, survey, sorry. Give me a break. We just had finals, okay? So, you know, I'm still in that mode. The survey that you took, it's what we call the seven cornerstones of a biblical worldview. I looked at your scores. I'll show you those in just a couple seconds. Y'all, if y'all were a church, you would be, literally, I'm not making this up to make you feel good so I can escape here alive. This is truth. You would be the most biblical church I've ever spoken in. So kudos to you. I'm proud of you. And you know from having looked at those seven questions, they're basic Bible. There's nothing deeply theologically profound about those questions. You know, is God the all-knowing, all-powerful creator of the universe who still rules it today? Duh. You know, but for most Americans, that's a brain twister. It's, ooh, I don't know. You know, that's not what Anthony Fauci believes. So, you know. But there's seven very basic questions. But in America, most people do not know the biblical answers. They do not believe the biblical answers to any of those seven questions. And so the context in which you're raising your child is one that will be constantly trying to drag them away from that biblical perspective. Why did those seven questions stand out? Because one night at like 3 a.m, I'm playing around with data, which is what I do for my jollies, and the Lord led me to realize when you put these seven items together, if somebody owns those seven questions as who they are, they believe them, they live them, they have an 83% probability of having a full biblical worldview. If you reject even one of those seven items, the probability of you having a biblical worldview drops to 2%. So what I'm suggesting to parents who feel like, gosh, I'm not capable of doing this, I don't know what a biblical worldview is, I don't know how to develop it, start here, because it's a great foundation. If this is all your children ever got from you, you've set them on a good course to move forward, not just believing it, but being able to convert those seven things into a lifestyle. And so, you know, our national study with children, kids between the ages of 8 and 12, found that only 3% of them believe and act on all seven of those items, only 3%. So again, it's very low. What that leads me to believe is that we're probably going to have 1.5 to 2% of today's 8 to 12-year-olds who wind up having a biblical worldview, maybe about 1% of them winding up as disciples of Jesus. In terms of the trajectory, again, we're continuing to decline. We got to turn that around. Here's how you all fared on these questions. After you took the test, survey. They sent me the answers, and I put them into this little chart for you. And so you can see that you all have the goods more than, you know, when I speak at pastors' conferences, and when we do something like this, their numbers are much worse than yours. Much worse. I tell you the truth. Much worse than yours. And so you have what it takes to raise your children as disciples, but you got to be intentional. You have to be strategic. You have to be consistent. You have to be undaunted by the culture, recognizing that God gave you this child to raise him or her up to be a disciple of Jesus. If you do nothing else in your life, if you accomplish that, you've accomplished much. Now, let me end here. They tell me I've got 20 seconds. I'm going to pretend that said 2 minutes. Zero here or there, who knows? So this is out of some of my more recent research. There's a big, 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 big caveat that goes with this, which is that the sample of homeschool teens that we had to work with is very small. So I'm not, you know, going on the sword on these data. But the reason I'm even showing it to you is because the patterns are so clear and they're consistent with everything else that I'm measuring, that I believe if we had a large enough sample size to justify all this statistically, it would be very, very similar to this. So what we're finding is among homeschool teens across America, when they get to answer these kinds of questions without their parents looking over their back, the kinds of answers that we're getting lead me to be a little bit cautious about what we're doing in homeschooling across the country. This group I feel pretty good about, but across the country we've got issues. So you can see, yeah, they're more likely to be self-identified Christians, but only 6 out of 10 homeschool teenagers in America even consider themselves to be Christian. That's a little scary. Only 1 out of 3 of them could be considered to be born-again Christians. Only 4% of them currently have a biblical worldview. So we've got issues there. Now, if we compare them to all other teenagers in the country, they're doing much better in terms of so many of the biblical indicators that we measure, whether it's beliefs or behaviors. But there's two ways of looking at this. One is, yeah, they're doing a lot better than the heathens. On the other hand, if we just look at the absolute numbers, those numbers are not where they should be. Not close to where they should be. What's my point to you? Don't take for granted that because you love the Lord, because you're trying to get your children to love the Lord, because what you're doing in homeschooling is allegedly geared to bringing them to the foot of the cross, that doesn't mean that that's where they're at. And so always be sensitive to what's going on there. This is the last slide I'll show you about that data. And it's intriguing to me because the behavioral numbers are much bigger than a lot of the belief numbers. It's not usually that way because you do what you believe. Why would you do something you don't believe? You wouldn't. You'd feel it's a waste of time. But what's happening here is that because they're still living at home and their parents are still expecting them to do certain religious activities, regardless of the substance of those activities and the impact of those activities, they're doing it. So, you know, the one that troubles me the most there is down at the bottom. I've got it in yellow. Only about 1 out of 3 of today's homeschool teenagers are reading or studying the Bible. That's a recipe for future disaster. So, you know, should you continue homeschooling? Yes, please do it. This is the ideal group to be doing that. You get it. You know where the path leads. Hopefully you know how to bring them there. And recognize that if you don't do it, the worldview vacuum in your child's life is going to be filled. Worldview will develop, whether you develop it or not. Somebody's going to develop it, and it's probably Hollywood, New York, through their media creations that are going to do it. That's what's happening with most children in America today. Hopefully that's not the case with your family, but recognize that your children are cultural targets. You are the buffer between your children and the culture. I didn't have time to go into my whole thing about what do you do with the media. I talk about that in the book. Actually, we have a chapter or two where we take the most popular children's media programming and we dissect the worldviews that are being communicated through it. It's frightening, but you need to know these things so you can do that. So go make disciples. I'm sorry I went over time, but God bless all of you. Thank you for what you're doing. Catch you later.